You're never going to have the perfect, ideal onboarding process, but you can keep getting better and you can aim to really, really take care of your people when you do it. So it's tough to call out who's doing well and who's not, because when you're not kind of in the doors of doing that, what I can tell you is I've worked at organizations that try really hard. So like my time at Glassdoor, that was probably one of the better examples of onboarding that I had seen, because they took a very prescriptive approach and they didn't look at onboarding as you're in onboarding for 2 weeks and then we throw you to the wolves. There was a longer, comprehensive process there.
This is Taking the Lead, a podcast for B2B tech professionals, leaders, and executives who want to learn from female icons in the tech industry. In each episode, host Christina Brady interviews women who are driving revenue for some of the most respected tech companies in the world. Are you ready to get inspired?
What's going on, everyone? I'm Jason Hassenberg, and you're tuning into the Go-to-Market Sour Sass Takes podcast, the show with sour takes and even sour candies. Today, I'm joined by with Christina Brady. Christina, she's a CEO and founder of a stealth startup named to be out soon. It's aimed at helping go-to-market professionals ramp up using role play, skill play, and the sales process simulations. She's also the host of the Taking the Lead podcast by Motion, a podcast focused on making sure female revenue leaders are able to be seen in the B2B SaaS space. Christina Brady, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm excited to tackle these five sour candies and your five sour takes. Let's just get started. The five sour candies today are going to be sour Skittles. The level is going to be up level 9. There's going to be sour popping candy by Warheads. That's a sour level 24. We're going to have Crybaby Tears. That's a sour level number 34. There's a Barnett's Mega Sour Candy. That's a level 40. And a Toxic Waste Nuclear Fusion, a level 43. What are your thoughts?
You know, I of all the flavor profiles that I'm a fan of, sour is the one at the very bottom. So I'm not bullish on this today. I'm going to do it, but there's going to be some potentially physical reaction. I also don't like how quickly they ramped up and you're like level 9. I was like, child's play. By the end, it's like level 50. I'm like, I'm going to die on this show. Fine. If that happens, remember me well.
Yeah, the first three, everyone's kind of been, hey, these aren't too bad. Then we get to fourth and fifth. They're in the 40 zone. And then everyone's just like, wow. And they need to take a second before answering their take. So if you need a moment, I hope you have a water next to you. We're going to get fired up. We're going to get sour. We're going to have a good time and hopefully have a couple good laughs along the way. So yeah. With that being said,
I've got a Diet Coke. I feel like that was potentially the choice.
I love the Diet Coke.
So we'll see how that goes.
I'm a big Diet Coke fan too. So I wish I had one next to me, but
yeah. Yep. So, you didn't think ahead.
I know I didn't. Exactly. We're not on the same wavelength right now. With that being said, sour take number one. Let's go ahead and take the sour Skittles out. We'll put them in our mouth and I'll read your sour take out loud.
I have to take all of them?
No, you don't have to. You could put one or two. I did all of them.
You did all sour of them? Fine.
Yeah. No one knows how to accurately measure ramp time. This is very pressing to me because I just was brought on the sales intel. And I'm kind of thinking the same thing. I don't know when I'm ramped up. So I'd love to hear your in-depth take about this.
Mm-hmm. So sour. So juicy. Not bad.
No,
you know,
I love it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here's
the thing. We got to prepare you, right?
Speaking of ramp up. Okay. So being in go-to-market for the last 16 years or so, on average, and I've usually worked at startups, scale-ups, and on average, it's always like a 3-month ramp, right? So they kind of say like, well, you know, one, most companies don't define what ramp actually means. Does ramp mean the first time that you sell a deal if you're a sales rep? Does ramp mean the first time that you're able to consistently hit quota on a repeatable basis outside of standard deviations?
Yep.
Does ramp time mean you're able to surpass your quota? Is ramp time when you're finally comfortable with the product? And that's going to be different for every company and every individual. But typically, It's, well, you know, it takes, I don't know, 3 to 6 months to ramp up, but we're going to put all of our AEs on a 3-month ramp. And after month three, and by the way, that's going to be an escalating ramp. So month one, don't worry. We're going to pay it in full. As if that's helpful, right? Because most sales cycles, even in SaaS, are 90 to 120 days. And that's not even assuming you're selling into the enterprise. So we give that 1 month, and then month two, we're kind of like, so, got any deals in the pipeline? And month two reps are like, what? I'm still learning. I don't know what's happening. I don't know what's going on. And I think the real number there, the real number there, honestly, if you look at full ramp as repeatability, scalability, understanding of customer, understanding of product, able to repetitively hit your quota, able to go and prospect effectively, building the right relationship with your BDR, if you have one.
Yeah.
I mean, you're looking at a year ramp. And it's crazy how many AEs we see right now that wind up going on performance improvement plans or PIPs before it's even been 6 months. And it's we are making our account executives pay the price for poor planning at go-to-market. And it's so sour, and we should stop doing that.
Why are companies pushing AEs to get ramped up in 3 months, right? Like, there has to be some sort of issue, you know, that's pushing us here.
Well, most of the time, you'll see that executive leaders are bearish initially on hiring sales reps because they're expensive. They take a long time to ramp, and they're really expensive if they have to turn over. So what usually happens is, you hire folks when you need them to produce. And you don't say, you know what, we're going to need an account executive to start really producing numbers in 9 months. So let's hire them now so that we need them in 9 months, because they're sitting there on your P&L for those 9 months knowing they're not going to produce. And companies sometimes don't have the runway, sometimes don't have the discipline, sometimes don't have the foresight to be able to do that. And I get it. I have been caught up in the world of, we got to hire a sales rep right now because we need the revenue right now. And so that's why that happens, is we hire them and we think, well, if we can train them a little bit more, but training never improves. And if we can get onboarding just a little bit better, and onboarding is never better because it is sitting on the backs of your enablement folks and your L&D folks who are also being tasked with 100 different things, and they can't even focus on the one thing, right? I don't know many companies have individualized custom onboarding by role, by tenure, because it's so hard to produce that. So instead, we hire folks, we throw them in the pool, and we say, take you like 6 to 9 months, but if you're not performing in three, we will put you on a PIP. Doesn't make any sense.
For the companies that have, you know, let's say a long runway, what's the typical process that you would set up, you know, having your experience, you know, how would you set that up compared to a company that has very little runway?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's tough because you can't do much about your runway when you're in it. So I understand having to hire people quickly and find a way to get to the number, right? Like there's a balance. Yeah. In an ideal world, you understand how long it takes to get to the factors that I laid out a moment ago when you are hiring people well in advance of that. And you at least have a way to figure out how to train them. Yeah. Because unless you've trained them to do the thing, you can't guarantee they know how to do the thing. Even if they worked at an identical company, a competitor, they've been in the industry for 30 years, right? If you haven't trained them when they walk in the doors or sit down at the Zoom of your organization, you can't guarantee they know it the way they need to. So you have to train them as a first step.
Yep.
Second step is, after they're trained, how do they practice? Do they have to go and do live fire calls with customers and burn those relationships because they're still learning? Yep. Right. If you ask a typical BDR at a SaaS company, they'll tell you that it takes 300 to 500 cold calls to get comfortable with their elevator pitch and discovery and objection handling. Think about all of those people that are getting that call because there's not a way for them to practice at scale. And then third, what does your coaching look like? And can you actually coach effectively? Do you have the right tools in order to do that? And do you have the built-in KPIs and metrics to measure a new employee versus a tenured employee? Do you have this idea of everboarding, where we are training folks all the time because our systems tell us what their gaps are? So learning and development is so much more complex and should be so much more comprehensive than classroom e-learning and then go live, do it, and then please hit the number. And if you do, we'll send you to Cabo. Yay.
What are some companies that are doing onboarding the right way?
You know, it's tough to say because so many companies that you would think are incredible with their onboarding programs honestly aren't. And I don't want to call any of them out.
Yeah.
I'm actually starting to see a trend right now in more startup type organizations, maybe your Series A to Series C companies that are really... an invested effort in onboarding their people. And it's never going to be perfect. You're never going to have the perfect, ideal onboarding process, but you can keep getting better and you can aim to really, really take care of your people when you do it. So it's tough to call out who's doing well and who's not, because when you're not kind of in the doors of doing that, what I can tell you is I've worked at organizations that try really hard. So like my time at Glassdoor, that was probably one of the better examples of onboarding that I had seen, because mm-hmm. they took a very prescriptive approach and they didn't look at onboarding as you're in onboarding for 2 weeks and then we throw you to the wolves. There was a longer comprehensive process there.
It's hilarious that you say that, because I've been in companies where I'm onboarded, right? And it's been mm-hmm. like a week and they're like, hey, like, where are the results? I'm like, I don't even know where your drive is. I don't even know where to find any of the materials to do this, right? And so when you're hiring somebody and you have limited runway, it to me seems like you need to be going out and finding someone that already has some sort of stability, right? You can't hire somebody who's just coming right out of college who has no sort of experience in sales, right? Like, so where is that, like, when you're hiring, where is that distinction in who you're looking for?
I would say early on when you're hiring, look for more qualitative transferable skills than quantitative skills. Some of the best salespeople that I've hired have been right out of college, or they've been prior teachers, or ballroom dancers, or ballerinas, or ice skaters, or bartenders, right? Like former bartender right here. So it's like, it's less about, do you have the selling experience? And it's more so, do you have transferable skills that you can speak to? How quickly can you learn? Do you like to learn? Mm-hmm. Are you a self-starter, right? Give them a script or a pitch and see how they pick up on it, right? Are they intrinsic? Are they passionate? Like, to me, very, very early on, especially if you haven't identified, this is who we want to hire, and we're kind of teasing one of my sour takes later, I've always looked at kind of outside of the norm for that. Absolutely know who you are targeting. You can be really smart about who you hire and where they come from, especially if you work at one of the organizations where you have a highly technical product, or you are talking to highly technical or highly specified buyers and you need someone who can speak the language. But you have to think about those things, right? Because let's say you have a highly technical product and you are talking to a very specified industry of professionals. Yep. You could have somebody who has sold for the last 25 years who could walk in the door and wouldn't be able to perform because they're still missing some critical pieces. So the lesson there is, like, understand who you have to hire and why.
Yeah. When you're, let's think about this from the other side, the person who's getting hired. What can you do in that ramp up period to actually set yourself up for success?
Yeah. One is, I mean, I've said it before, it's finding opportunities to practice what you are learning out loud and getting what I call in body, right? Yeah. So I can watch somebody run a marathon. It would likely be very boring, but I could watch it. I could study their body. I could see when they need to get a drink. I could see maybe when they have bad form, if I've studied that before, you know, and I could have somebody coach me, you know, a little bit on running. But until I actually get into practicing how to do the thing, I'm not going to watch somebody run a marathon and then go run a marathon, right? Like, there's that element of, I've seen it, I've been trained on it. Now I have to go do it. I have to go practice so that I can feel that. So that's the first thing, is be aware of your gaps. The second thing is, don't be afraid to ask for help and call out what you don't know, because one of two things, right? You're either going to lead with ego, which I get, like, salespeople. Look, I'm a salesperson, right?
You have
to have a high level of ego. You have to.
You do.
But if that ego is, I can't not know the answer to something, I have to be the expert all the time. If that ego is guiding you in that direction, then your customers are going to catch you when you don't know something, and you're going to ruin the relationship. So at some point in time, you're going to hit a moment of, damn it, I don't know. It's better to do that before you're on the call with the customer than during, when you finally have to say, I actually don't know the answer to that because I never looked at it. So figure out what you don't know. Ask the top reps about the calls that they botched and why they botched them, right? Most people are like, here, listen to all these calls. These are really good calls. I used to say, listen to all the terrible calls. Like, rip the calls apart. Like, listen to the bad, because you get an equal understanding of how to be good by doing that.
It's hilarious, again, that you say that, because I feel like when you get brought onto an organization, they want to show you their good side, their good face, right? They don't want to show you the bad that's going on. Whereas a lot of the bad that's going on, you can actually get a lot of the learnings from, right? Like you're saying, the calls that are happening, maybe it's the outreach that was taking place, you know, 6 months ago when you were just spamming everybody, or, you know, the LinkedIn, you know, engagement where you really weren't engaging with anybody and you were just basically spamming people on LinkedIn, right? I don't think companies are willing to share that bad side. But to me, that's where you could actually grow. And when you're bringing new people on, you have to prepare them for any situation, right? And so when I'm asking, when I want to ask you this as a follow-up question, how can there be a good balance between the person who's coming on, right? The person who's being ramped up and the company that's helping them ramp up? How can there be a sort of equilibrium or make sure they're on the same wavelength in that onboarding session?
Your employees are there to work to build your vision and make you legendary. And I believe in treating employees that way. So if I'm going to bring you into my organization, and I'm speaking as a CEO right now, right? If I'm going to bring you into my organization to build my vision, one, I want to enable you to feel like you have a part of that. I want you to understand the impact that you're making every single day. I want you to feel like we can't achieve what now we collectively want to achieve without you. And so it comes down to, as an employer, I want my employees to feel a large sense of purpose and welcoming and belonging. I want them to feel like they have resources. Yeah. Now, notice I'm not saying I want them to feel like they're a part of my family. I'm not, right? Like it's so different, you know? And so, and I think that's where the mistake is, where it's like, it is a work relationship, but you are spending a lot of moments of your life at this company working to build this. I want to make that worth your while, and I want to make sure that you have what you need to feel the personal satisfaction that makes it worth it to wake up every day and come to work at this company.
There's nothing worse than, you know, a CEO or a founder being like, yeah, like it's our baby. Like we're all, you know, like, and it's like, no, it's not, right? I have this is a 9-to-5 for me. And I think that you have to be upfront about that. And I think you hit the nail on the head when it comes to respecting your employees, making sure that you're listening to them, listening to what they want, listening to what you want, so that you can actually find a path towards success. Because at the end of the day, this is just another role to them. And they're looking to get something out of it as well, right? They want to polish their sales skills or their marketing skills. They want to move up the chain and become a manager or a VP one day. And so the more you can actually get aligned with what their goals are and they can align with what your goals are, you're on a better path, right?
Yeah, so, that's thank right. You. And yeah, folks coming to work for you and wanting it to be, as you said, just a 9-to-5, hey, that's okay. Yeah. And like the company, the product might not be your baby, but you feeling pride over the work that you're doing every day, that could be. It's okay if it is. It's okay if it isn't. I want the time that you're spending here to be personally fulfilling for you. And whatever that looks like, I want to find out so I can support it. Like it's that simple.
Love that. Love that. That leads us into our second sour take. Let's go ahead and try our second sour candy. It's going to be the Warheads popping candy. So you've heard of Pop Rocks, right?
Yes, I've heard of. No, I've
right?
Yeah, I know what Pop.
I had that, I think, maybe delicious. 6th or 8th grade. My last time I've had Pop Rocks. Jared really loved this candy, so
really
I'm
going to
go ahead and bite it. Yeah. Okay. So we'll go ahead and put it in our mouth. Industry and prospect knowledge outweighs product knowledge. I'd love for you to dig deep.
I hate it. I hate it so much.
Really?
Yeah.
It feels weird when it's like bubbling in your mouth and it's sour.
In the back. It's in my ears.
My tongue is blue.
Yeah, mine's green. Sour take. Let's do it.
Sour take number two. We'll rewind again. Industry and prospect knowledge outweighs product knowledge.
Hmm.
I want your 2 cents on this.
People are going to disagree with me on this one. I know it, especially CEOs that love their product, and I am one of those, right?
Yep.
Oftentimes, when you are hiring and onboarding your teams, it's, we got to just download on the product, right? Product knowledge, product knowledge. Like, and look, knowing and understanding the product is unbelievably important. But knowing and understanding your product means you could make the mistake of leading with the product instead of leading with the value and the pain that you are solving. And so if you understand the industry that you are selling to, what are their pains? What are their goals? What are their motivations? What kinds of tools do they usually shop for? What does their tech stack currently look like? What are the gaps that you can find in their tech stack that you could potentially fill? What are the roles that are buyers? How do you multi-thread, right? All of these things, that industry and prospect knowledge of understanding, how do I talk to these people? What are their personalities like? What does their body language look like? How do they like to be communicated with? All of that is going to trump the product knowledge. You could be the product expert at the company.
So
and in fact, the product experts at the company, usually, unless you have somebody very special, don't even want to get on the call with your customers. Right? No. Like they're like, I'm behind the curtain. Don't talk to me. Look at me.
True.
I am not street legal. I don't want to be talking to any of the, right? So it's you have to have that knowledge of how to talk to people and find the problem and know enough about the product to be prescriptive and start selling when it's time to sell the product. And that is not at the beginning of the conversation. Sometimes it's not even in the middle of the conversation, because if you go along with the four ways that people buy anything anytime, it's, do I have a problem?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, should I solve it? Should I solve it now? And should I solve it with you, right? When I go to buy anything, when I decide where I'm going to go to lunch, like, am I hungry? Do I want to eat? Do I want to eat right now? Do I want to eat Taco Bell? Answer is always yes, but I go through those four steps. So the first three don't have much to do with your core product knowledge. It is all industry prospect knowledge that's going to get you there. And by the time you're there, if you are at a point where you're not super comfortable talking about the product on a technical level, this is where you can ask for help, bring somebody in until it's there. But train your people on industry and prospect knowledge first.
How do you train people on industry and prospect knowledge, right? Let's just dig deep into that.
It's actually a little bit easier because there's more of a wealth of information on something that is more agnostic like that, right? Like when you're, most of the time, your in-depth product knowledge, you can only uncover what your prospects can on your own website, right? Unless you work in a company, you're usually not getting the view behind the scenes at all of the magic happening with the product. But in terms of the industry and prospect knowledge, right, I can study different prospect personas. I can listen to calls with folks and pick up on their vernacular and their tonality and how they like to communicate, right? I can do research on the industry. I can do research on tech stack. I can use tools like ZoomInfo and Apollo to find out what do they currently have and what are their pains, right? I can go on LinkedIn and I can find the people at various organizations that I want to sell to, and I can look at what they're posting and what they're asking help with. There is a wealth of information on top of what likely your company already has to train you on those things. So if you're ramping up or if you're currently having a really hard time hitting your quota, that's a great place for you to start to figure out where you can sharpen.
Yeah. And for someone who, let's just say for someone who has been in the industry for a long time, the industry has changed, right? We've dramatically changed over the last 10 years. What's your advice to them to dig back in?
I mean, it's the old idea of like agility versus absorption.
Yeah.
Things are never going to stop changing. They're always going to be evolving, right? In 2018, if I were to say, you know what, go cold call for an hour, everyone would look at me like I was nuts.
Yeah.
Today, go cold call for an hour. Like it's actually starting to work, right? It's like,
People fire up about it.
Yeah. Like the old trends are all coming back, right? Like, and then in 2020, it was use LinkedIn to reach out to your prospects. And then all of a sudden now it's, can we end the LinkedIn pitch slapping? Like it's always going to evolve. It's always going to change. So identify the areas where you need to be agile. And agility could be, who am I reaching out to? When am I reaching out to them? How am I reaching out to them? What am I doing before I reach out to them? And do I have a knowledge of what they're doing to learn about my brand before I tap them, right? So now we're getting down the web of attribution, which I know some people heard that and probably started like sweating a little bit. I'm not going to talk about attribution. But ideally, every customer that you're talking to has had some interaction with your brand before you got there. Do you know what that interaction is so that you can pick up on the momentum? And then there's absorption, right? If you are a salesperson, you're going to get punched in the face.
Yep.
And by salesperson, that's BDR. AE, sales leader, VP of sales, CRO, CEO, right? All of us get on calls with customers, and all of us have had a customer punch us in the face, metaphorically, hopefully not literally. People punch in the face, literally. Message me on LinkedIn because I want to hear about it. But like, So understand that you're going to do some things that are not going to work. You're going to get punched in the face. You're going to hear no. You're going to. And it's hard. By the way, hearing no is really hard. And when people are mean to you, it's really hard. And I never want to discount that and say, like, just let it roll off your shoulders. Like, we're biologically wired to not be dismissed or rejected in such a way. So it is difficult. But then it comes back to the agility. I did something with that person that didn't work. Why did it not work? Was it me? Or was it that tactic would work on somebody else, but it wouldn't work on that type of person? And can I identify what those factors are? Nothing is black and white.
I love that. I love that. So when you're, let's just say you're identifying an account, we can just say it's Gong. Okay. You're tasked with Gong. So how, what's your process there? And let's just say you're aimed at trying to target Udi Lagore.
Yeah. Well, I'm connected with Udi, so I just hit him up on LinkedIn. Pitch slap him. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, first thing is, okay, if we're going after somebody who is in an executive seat at a fairly notable organization, right? We will say that they have people in their LinkedIn inbox consistently all the time. So I'm probably not going to go directly after that person all the way at the top, but I'm going to look at who's surrounding them. Who are their people of influence and what do they care about? And can I offer them a piece of value before I jump in and just assume that they have a problem that they want to solve right now with me, right? I'm assuming all of those things when I reach out and I give you my elevator pitch. For me, it's what can I do to make you curious? What can I do to be helpful? Can I invite you somewhere? Can I send you an article with no ask in return? Can I start interacting with your content on LinkedIn, right? Like, how do I make myself familiar? Can I go to my marketing team and say, look, I want to have an ABM motion on these top 10 accounts. How is marketing engaged with these accounts? Have we invited them anywhere? Have they attended a webinar? Have they been hand raisers on our website? Have they even visited our website? How can we get them there? Can we put together a targeting ad, right? So what you're hearing me say is you don't have to go it alone with these big accounts. You just sit there at your desk alone in your office and say, I'm doing it all by myself. Right. You have a go-to-market team there to help you to engage and get in front of customers. And if you are not able to do it, if you're banging on a brick wall and nobody is answering, engage the helpers around you to see what you can do.
That's a really, really interesting take there to actually go at it in a team motion instead of just thinking, oh, it's just me. It's just my profile on LinkedIn I have to use. Let's get people involved. Right. And I think that's the type of energy sales teams need to have in 2024, right? Like, I think 2022, 2021, even 2023, it was like, okay, everybody, all AEs, SDRs, you're on your own. Like, just go, you know, hit your lists as much as possible, put them in a sequence. And I think now you hit it right on the head. We got to rally the troops. Marketing is becoming sales as well. We're all one motion, the go-to-market motion, right? And if we can work together. And I was talking to Mason Cosby about ABM and Tim Davidson. So it's really, really a hot topic right now. If we can work together on these list of accounts, why wouldn't we, right? Why spin our wheels when we don't have to?
Boom.
Sour take number three, Christina, are you ready to go?
Yes.
This one is the crybaby tears, a level 34. The last one was a 24. These won't get sour until you start like chewing them. So.
How many did you just take?
All four. You don't have to. All right. Sour take number three. AI to replace humans will slow us down.
Mm-hmm.
AI to help improve human performance will speed us up. Reading this was a really, really great. I love this take. So I really want to get into your head here and talk about why you're thinking this way.
Yeah. Obviously, the AI revolution is among us, right? Like, you can't, Brandon, I'm the CEO of an AI company. So, like, I'm part of it. I'm the monster, right? But, like, here's the thing. There's a lot of different applications of AI. There's a lot of sloppy renditions of AI technology. There's a lot of technology that is not artificial intelligence or generative intelligence or conversational intelligence that is pretending to be artificial intelligence. And so first thing I will say is there's a lot of mistrust in this field. If you've gone on and done a free AI headshot, you've probably gotten like a really weird result. And speaking personally here, I decided I was like, I'm just going to play around and see what I can get out of an AI shot. And the results were horrific. It was like if the picture could talk, it would have been like, kill me. Like, it was a weird hand. And I was like, hot, right? So there's a lot of technology out there. Some of it is brilliant and amazing. Some of it is really, really sloppy. And I get it, because we're all kind of learning how to use the technology properly.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people have this big fear that AI in some way, shape, or form is going to replace people. Heck, if we look at, you know, the big Hollywood writer strike that we just got passed, right? Where you have writers and actors who are saying AI is now going to be writing screenplays and replacing actors and replacing writers and replacing directors and replacing the folks who were like, what is going to happen to art, which is inherently a human form? And so there's a threat of, well, if we have AI, my God, like, we can replace BDRs and we can replace.
What are we going to do?
Well, and we can replace receptionists and we can. And for me, it's not about replacing people. How do we take this technology and use it to strengthen human beings and keep human beings at what they are good at, which is interacting with each other and having that human element that I personally don't think a machine can really replicate, right? And now 20 years from now, somebody might play this and be like, remember when you said, but really. And so even if I use my own company as an example, right, where I am rolling out a company where you can practice with a simulation of your customer. You can practice skill drills. You can practice role plays. You can practice full conversations. You can get intelligence about what you could have done better from a qualitative and quantitative standpoint. But you can about to go on a call with a VP of sales that you're nervous about to negotiate and practice that exact call with that person before you go on it, right? Cool.
Gosh.
But at the end of the day, I'm not saying, you know what, let the system go sell for you. It's going to use practice and strengthen in a safe environment that is free of judgment, that is going to give me the analytical advice at scale that's difficult for my manager to do right now because they have 10 other priorities and, heck, 100 other priorities. And then I'm going to go be the strongest version of me when I'm selling to that customer, and I'm going to impact the company that way. So it's the AI that's replacing people. You know, it's not that it scares me. It makes me kind of sad, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it makes me sad because, there's magic in what people can do together. And so how do we use some of this incredible technology to make each other better so that we can go be better humans?
Yeah, there's sort of two sides of the coin, right? One side of the coin's like, oh man, everyone's going to be replaced. Very depressing type of feel. You know, we're all going to be, it's going to be like WALL-E, right? We're all going to be sitting on our chairs, 500 pounds heavy, right? Whereas like the other side of the coin. The other side of the coin is like, hey, we actually can use this to our advantage. We can solve a bunch of different problems that are in healthcare. We can solve the issues that we're having in our tech stack and the way we're outreaching. And we could actually, instead of spending 8 hours a day working, we could all spend 5 hours a day and get the same benefit out of it, right? Now, that sounds cool to me, right? So from your understanding, because I know now that a lot of companies are trying to incorporate AI into their trainings and also into their, obviously, their products. And so speaking to your company exactly, what are the best ways to incorporate AI when you're, let's just focus on the sales leader, right? How can you incorporate something to actually make it beneficial?
Is the AI solving a core problem that you have, or is it just a cool piece of technology? And it's tough to decipher between those two things, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's neat if you have AI that can do something really cool. But at the end of the day, the KPIs and the metrics and what we have to do to grow revenue teams and ultimately hit the multipliers and the plan that we have to at various orgs and different stages of growth, like, that formula hasn't changed a ton. And so I think there can be a lot of distraction with new technology of doing something really cool versus saying, hey, yes, this is a neat tool and I like how it functions, and this is going to help me do XYZ faster. I'm going to get to target faster. I'm going to find the companies faster. We're going to shorten our sales cycles. We're going to increase our win rate. We're going to improve the culture. We're going to improve the morale. We're going to ramp faster. We're going to actually be able to measure ramp, right? Like, can we deploy technology in a way that solves a core problem that is not yet solved or not yet solved well? If the answer to that is yes, play away, my friends. Play away.
Let me highlight one of the problems that you brought up earlier, which was like sales training and how a lot of people like myself, I remember I was an intern, I'm like 20 years old, I'm in an office at a software development company, and they have me on the phones, and I have no clue what the hell I'm doing, right? So I'm just calling people, burning bridges left and right, and I'm feeling like my head's about to explode. And I think I left that internship after like 3 months. I actually spent time in the office not even calling because I was just like, I don't even know where to start. And so I just want to know from your standpoint, how do you actually help someone with trainings, and how are you actually able to measure when someone's ready in when it comes to a tool like yours, right? Because I think it's incredibly helpful, and I've seen, you know, the need for it in the market from my own experience.
Thank you. When you're training anybody to do anything, one, you have to understand how long does it take a human to learn something? And not how long do we want it to take? How long does it take? And how many times do I have to repeat that thing before it becomes muscle memory? And it's a lot more than you realize it. And that's where the ability to practice really comes into play, is getting those repetitions in to create the ability to be comfortable and to play with the various factors that you're going to have in your job before the customer punches you in the face with them. And the other thing is, in general, when you're looking at training somebody to do anything, it's what happens when I've introduced a new thing to you, right? Here's the new thing that you have to do. Okay, what happens in the next hour? And then what do we do in the next day? And then what's the plan for the next week? And then what's the plan for the next month, right? And so it's laying out, how am I going to help this person learn, starting very, very small, and guide you through that. And also make sure that you're aware of it. If you've ever been in a process that's really uncomfortable and you don't know the next steps, it actually makes you worse at that process. And I'll give you an example. So many companies don't lay out like their interview process. Or you ever feel like you go in an interview for a company and you're like, oh, this is an interview for this new company. I'm so excited, right? And you have the first interview with the hiring, you know, like with the person from HR or TA, and you're like, it was amazing. Yes. And then you're like, and someone's like, what are the next steps? And you're like, I don't know. And you're like, shoot, I should have asked that. Okay. So then the next call you get on, you're with the hiring manager and you're like, this feels big. Oh my gosh, that call was amazing. It was wonderful.
Yep.
And then you know, what are the next steps? And usually they're like, well, if you make it past this point, then it might be a presentation. It might be a role play, could be a panel. We don't know. And the entire process goes like that. Now, that's probably 90% of companies. There are 10% out there that will sit there and say, this is our hiring process. This is first, second, third. This is the time it takes in between these things. You will understand the next steps before the end of the day, each time that you have a step with us in this process. And when you have that, you can grab onto it and you're like, I know the process. I can be so much better now because I can prepare for that. I know what the timing is. I can keep my family and friends updated on my progress.
Yes.
Versus throwing people into it, which unfortunately is most of the experience.
Oh, oh my gosh. You're speaking to the choir here. I was going through interviews. Yeah. I mean, I'd go, right? And even just going back, because I was in the interview process, I know exactly what you're talking about. And when you're in something like that and you don't know the steps ahead of it, you almost feel like you took one step forward, now you're taking two steps back. And then by the end of it, you're tired out. You're like, okay, I'm on my eighth interview step. There can't be another one, right? Like, I already met with the CEO. What else got ahead of me? And it's funny because when you could gamify it, right? Like, you see a lot of these like Call of Duty or like, but even, you know, Mario Kart, they have some sort of like actual challenges that you work towards, and you can see like, okay, I'm trying to get to level 60. And so when you gamify it, I think it actually makes the experience better, and it also makes your company look better.
Yeah. 100%.
Anything else you'd like to add to this sour take before we move on to sour take 4?
I feel like we hit it so good. We just...
Yeah, we crushed it. We
crushed that sour take.
Sour take number 4. Now, I'm going to warn you, this has been the most sour candy that everyone said should be the 5th. Yes.
This little bit of hatred?
Yes.
I have to consume.
So, this one will... make you cringe a little bit. Sour take number 4.
Like, sides of my mouth are already hurting and I haven't even...
Once you get through the exterior, You'll be fine. Here we go.
Oh, yeah. No.
Sour take number four. There is no single most successful rep profile.
Oh my God.
That's okay. How brutal is that?
Ooh. Ugh.
You okay?
My whole body just pursed right up with that one.
Did you get it out of there?
Yeah, I spit that out. I was like, I can't talk. I'm going to have to sit here in silence. I'm sweating in places that I haven't sweat in years. Okay. There is no single most successful Okay. There is no single most successful rep profile. We hinted at this earlier, but I can't tell you how many companies like, yeah, we have our ICP. Yeah, our ideal candidate profile. And I was like, that's great. You should have that. And then when you look at it, it is this narrow, rigid list of on paper qualifications. Did you just? I did.
Uh-huh.
I was like, how is this still?
I couldn't talk to you.
You know what? Yeah, I'm happy that's no longer inside of you. Because now we can move on.
Sorry. I'm sorry for cutting you off.
I love it. I was like, how do I dodge the camera to spit this up? Where'd she go? Where
I'm
is
gonna
she?
Get a screenshot of you if you didn't.
Don't you
I'm
do
joking.
Me. Yeah. Yes. And when you look at it, people who have this really, really detailed ICP, ideal candidate profile, oftentimes then follow up by saying it's impossible to hire. And the people that we hire don't work out. And then they go onto platforms like Pavilion or LinkedIn or whatever it may be and say, hey, we're having a really hard time hiring. And when we do hire, people are turning over so fast and we can't figure it out. And it kind of goes back to this idea that if you are being so narrow with who you are looking for on paper, you are likely missing out on incredible talent that could work there simply because you haven't recognized that you can train them on most things. Now, I understand there are certain industries and companies where you have to have a certain level of experience. I get that. And I am certainly not discounting it.
Yeah.
But don't discount the ability of smart, hungry, driven, passionate people to learn what they have to learn to do the job.
So true.
Right? Most people have a high level of acumen in a job that they didn't go to school for.
Yeah.
Like when we're in our industry.
And so true.
Yeah, your ideal candidate profile that you built that you're very proud of, that might work. It also might not work. And you should also give a chance on somebody that doesn't look perfect on paper. Like, talk to that person that you think might have transferable skills. Train your people on how to look for that. Train your people on how to interview for that. Right? If you've got 10 skills that you are looking for and somebody fits five of them, talk to that person.
Seriously.
Right? Because what I hear when people are so rigid with their candidate profile when they don't have to be is, sounds like you have a sucky training program. Sounds like you don't know how to enable people. You don't know how to train them on your product. It sounds like your people are failing and not hitting quota and you're blaming them for that en masse, right? Like if you have a go-to-market team that is blaming all their sales reps on their inability to hit quota, run far from that
Seriously.
Organization because it's not the AE's fault that they're not hitting quota. Right. And it's not because your ICP is off. So it's like, this is one where it's a level four sour because we get it wrong so much and we discount people's ability to learn how to do a job. And it drives me nuts.
Yeah. This one rubs me wrong in all different ways. Like I just from personal experience, my mother who raised four kids was out of the school industry she was a teacher for a few years out for 25. Goes to go back to become a teacher again, and they feel like she doesn't have the technical skills to learn, like to teach, which in my opinion, that's the reason why, like, you have to teach those technical skills. They don't just come. And so, like, after I think it's been 15 years, my mom was a substitute teacher for 7 years. She's now been a teacher for 7 years and she knows all of it, right? But it was this level of like, how do I even get into the door? Right. And like, I know I don't want to jump to sour take number five, but it's like a lot of times you actually have to use connections that you know to even be able to break the surface. And I have friends who want to get into the tech industry who I know would kill it, but they didn't go to college, right? They didn't, right? That's the ultimate barrier. People always, you have to go to college. I was a college, I went to college and I was big on it until I was in the tech industry, and I was around very, very smart, hardworking people who were crushing quota, crushing goals, who never went to college, who instead had to raise a kid, who maybe had a kid when they were 18, right? And I think this just, it bothers me so much, because when you look at companies and there's this gap between actually having skillful workers and people who are just filling seats, you just look around and you can see, I could count on my hand 10 people who have been excused from the tech industry. And I'm sure you're feeling the same way. You have your own experience.
Well, what you're talking about, I think, is something that's so important and so impactful. And in fact, when you're talking about, you know, folks who have had kids young or have gone through struggles in life or haven't had the ability or the privilege to be able to go to college or have that level of education, 9 times out of 10, I'm hiring those people. Like, you give me the single mom that had to find a way to get through with a young child while they were a kid. Like, I want that tenacity at my company, right? Yeah. Like the, and that's gender agnostic, right? It's like, for me, experiences that you've been through in your life and the obstacles that you've had to overcome to get where you are so meaningful and so translatable to work. And it's like to look at somebody and say, God, you're perfect, but you don't have that MBA, right? I remember when I was when I was working at a prior company, I'm not going to say which one. I remember the CEO, I wanted to be a VP at that company. Like, my goal was like, I'm going to be a VP. I can't wait. And I remember there was a new CEO and they brought him in, and he, you know, he's talking to all of the leaders and, you know, at the company at one point. It's like, yeah, you know, like, one of the things that we're really trying to embrace is we're looking to hire for our exec leadership is we want folks who have an MBA. And he starts listing off all of these credentials. And I'm sitting here raised by a single mother who was a musician who died when I was young and having to pick myself up and going, God, like, I would have had, I don't have an MBA. Like, I don't have that. I'm instantly unqualified from being a VP at this company because I don't have that. But like, what about my life experience? And so
seriously,
it is a blend of the two, right? Like, on the job experience, understanding what you're doing, like, those are very, very important. But I look at your life experience equally to what I do your job experience.
If you had a few words, and you can take as long as you want to talk to the people who have been counted out due to one of those reasonings that we've mentioned, what advice would you give them?
Going further than advice, I find a lot of people like that don't understand how to speak about their struggle as if it is their strength, because they inherently view it as a weakness because everybody has told them that it is a weakness. And so sometimes the easiest way to get past that is you find somebody like me, right? You come find me, you message me, you tell me your story. I will listen to it. I will gain the utmost respect for you. And I will tell you your story back and tell you how strong you are. And I will help you grab hold of the narrative of your life. And sometimes you need someone's help to see yourself, right? Like, sometimes you can't get away from your mirror. And so you need a new mirror. So you go find somebody to be your mirror and find your strength when you can't. And that's okay, right? I always say, like, if it's dark, you might not be buried, you might be planted. Find the person that sees that you're planted.
Oh, I love that. I love that. I love just the energy you give off, especially talking about this topic. It just fires me up because I think we could talk about this all day, right? I think there's so much to go into. And I was going to bring up, how do you, because these people do see it as their weakness. I mean, for me, especially, I always felt like, okay, I don't want to talk about my weaknesses because it might make me look like I'm not confident enough, right, in my abilities. And I think there are some EQ that goes into that, where it's like, actually, you need to be able to know what you're not good at. You need to be able to know what situation you came from, and you need to be able to read the room and know what to say and when not to. But for people who have never had to experience that, like, I had a mentor, his name was Rob Stein. And he really was the one to look at me and say, hey, like, you actually have talent, like, you have the will and want. Did you have the greatest background? No. Did you have loving parents? Yes. Did they push you to work hard? Yes. And use that energy, use that to motivate you for whatever you do. Right. And so when I was starting this podcast, to me, I always had doubts. I'm like, are these people going to join, or people going to listen? Am I just wasting my time? And at some point, you just got to say, you know what? I've been through all of this crap, you know, and I'm just going to start it because I will regret it later if I don't. Now, if I start it and something happens, at least I can say I did it and I'll learn from it, right?
That's right. That's right. Because what I'm hearing you say is like, you bend, you don't break. Yeah. And that's its own form of strength, right? Is,
yeah.
I can't say that I'm the strongest, most rigid person out there, but I'm going to bend. I'm not going to break, right? And sometimes that's viewed as a higher amount of strength than anything else. And like, yes, we don't know. I'm going to say it again. We don't know how much time we have here, right? Like, we have to live every day out loud. We have to make every day mean something because we're not going to be this version of ourselves and who we are today forever. And you're writing the story of your life right now. And so don't create a chapter that 80-year-old you, willing that we all get there, is going to look back and be like, man, I wasted that year.
Yeah, you're what the fuck, right?
Like, you're in that year right now. So like, make it mean something.
What is an example of someone that you worked with or hired and they went on the kill it? Is there, you don't have to say their name, but I would love to hear, and you don't have to hear say their background, but I would love to hear just a good success story.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about a dear friend of mine. Her name's Erin O'Malley. And she currently right now, she's like an enterprise director, VP at Sprout Social. She's incredible. And I first met her when we were at Groupon, and I was an exec at Groupon, and I was in charge of building pilot teams. And I remember I was hiring for a brand new initiative. We were going to try out verticalizing instead of having everybody calling on everything. It was like, what if we are verticalized in food, health and beauty, leisure, right? So we're like, okay, we're going to pilot it. Christina's team's going to pilot this. And I remember she was late, not late to the interview, but late to the interview process. Like, she was out of town. She was gone. I'd already decided who I was going to hire.
Yeah.
And I'm very bullish. So I was like, I got my people. We're going to go. Let's do it. And Jenny Floros, who is another incredible leader that I've had the honor of working with. Can you tell it's getting nighttime here? It's like getting dark. I like can't figure my lighting out. I'm like, my God, it's like, here we go. I'll just be very yellow.
It looks and good.
Here we go. And she said, you got to talk to Erin. She's incredible. And I was like, I've unfortunately already picked a team. And she's like, just talk to her. So I said, okay, fine. I'm not going to pass up an opportunity to talk to somebody. Yeah. And she wound up being somebody that changed my life. She changed me. I remember our conversation, we didn't talk about the job at all. She was talking about her life and her experiences and why she, and it was just, I was enamored with how brilliant she was and how kind she was and her incredible contagious energy. Wow. And then I had the honor of working with her, not only the rest of my tenure at Groupon, I got to work with her at Glassdoor, and she to this day remains one of my dearest friends and one of the people in my life that I think has shaped me into the human and leader that I am by just watching her grace. And she's one of those where I was like, look, you are starting on my team.
Wow.
But I hope one day I report to you. And that's my goal with anybody who works for me is like, I want to work for you one day. Like, I'm not your ceiling.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I'm your stairs. I'm gonna like, let's get you there. Right. So one day I'm going to work for Erin O'Malley, and it's probably going to be the best job I ever have.
That's just such a magical story. And it fills your heart, right? When your mission is not to just bring in revenue, right? And your mission's actually to build a team, and you watch your team actually be able to pay for groceries, go on vacations, and right. That actually is the most fulfilling part of being a leader. I had the privilege of leading, you know, 8 BDRs, and seeing them actually grow and go to different places has been the most rewarding part of my experience so far.
This toxic waste one is staring at me.
Are you ready to go? Sour take number 5. Toxic waste. Put it in. It won't get too sour till you bite into it. So if you want to hold on that, be careful. It's a level 43. Sour take number 5. Hiring referrals only kills diversity, equity, and inclusion. Love that we're ending on this one. Are you okay?
That was the worst one.
Oh, you thought
that was the worst one because the flavor of it was also gross. Like,
yeah.
I felt like the other one, the flavor was like kind of watermelon-y, and I was like, you know, okay, gross. That one was horrific.
Melissa Gaglione, she got put it down right away. I could tell that she hated the taste. So,
like, I still feel like I'm tasting it, but it's sitting in this napkin, just like a little
for later.
Yes. Most companies are like, we will only hire based on referrals. And I get that. But if you are trying to increase your DE&I initiatives and you are looking around the company at a bunch of people who look alike, think alike, and have the same experiences, their referrals are going to look and think like they do 9 times out of 10. And so if you are only hiring from referrals, most people very naturally, right? This goes back to like humans being part of a tribe and like yep. versus ego, is we are attracted by people who look like us and think like us. And that's getting better. But most of the time, you are going to wind up hiring people and not solving the problem and wondering why DE&I is still an issue. And so mm-hmm. referrals are amazing because you want to move fast and you have to trust people. But if you're not careful, it goes the other way.
Yeah. And I'd love to hear from your point of view. I don't know if you have an experience from when it went wrong and you're just like looking back at your team or a team that you've joined and you've been like, wow, yeah, this isn't diverse. This isn't, you know, this doesn't include everyone.
I mean, for me, it's been listening to diverse voices and understanding where it's appropriate for me to have a voice in that room and an opinion in that room and where it's appropriate for me to just listen and educate myself. And also learning truly what DE&I actually means, right? Because I think a lot of folks don't understand this idea of equality versus equity. The idea that like in an equitable world, we're not eliminating any race, creed, color, belief, religion. It's everybody has a seat at that table equally based on their merit. And that we want to make sure that we get as even a pie as we can, not because that's nice and it's kumbaya and it feels good, that is there, but also your company is going to be better off when you have that diversity of experience from all walks of life, because that's how you make sure that you're covering all of your bases. So for me, it's learned that it's not just nice to have to hire people who look and think differently, right? It's also like kind of critical
yeah.
if you want your business to succeed and grow. And I represent a small portion of diversity. I represent a woman. I represent a mother, right? And some other yeah. things. But I'm also coming to this with a high level of privilege and understanding that representing some diversity doesn't mean representing all, and that I could even be better, right? When I look mm-hmm. at folks in years past that I've referred to roles, do they, for the most part, have they looked and thought like me? Absolutely. Until mm-hmm. I started to challenge that and realize that I needed to expand my network and embrace other people as a part of my life and my friendships. And that's when you kind of improve as a human being as well, as when you realize that you are accidentally eliminating incredible people who could be in your life that could teach you something.
I feel like Chicago is the melting pot for all different types of individuals, which is, I think we're fortunate enough to live in Chicago to experience that, right? And I think, you know, like what just what you said, when you have a team with different opinions and different ways of thinking and different backgrounds, one thing that might seem very clear to you, like we need to do this, will right. seem very unclear to someone else, right? And they'll say, why are, let's hold up. Let's put the brakes on and understand why are we even doing this, right? And so when you're hiring a team, and I know you're focused on ramping up sales leaders, right? And so when you're hiring a team, how do you juggle the referrals while also going out and actually look in? How do you look for, you know, are you looking for people? Are you posting on LinkedIn? How are you making sure that you're getting a diverse, you know, set of people that are applying?
I have to make sure that I'm putting myself where those people are.
Okay.
And a lot of times you're having to realize that this system, especially this industry, in a lot of senses, will now start to hire diversity in roles like BDR or AE or CS rep. And the higher up you go in an organization, the less diverse it gets, even from like a simple gender split standpoint. So on the one hand, it's how do I look at the unbelievable potential of somebody that might be more in a frontline role and say, I'm going to go on a limb and I'm going to promote you to the next role because I believe that you have that and you haven't been given a chance to shine. So one mm-hmm. is, do I understand how to look and see talent,
okay.
even if your resume doesn't dictate it right now? And the second piece is community is huge for this, right? Like I'm in the women in sales community. Alex Imudawar is the CEO of that. And that's an unbelievably diverse and incredible organization with tons of women who are salespeople in technology and some of the most brilliant sellers and leaders that I've met are in that group, right? And
yeah.
so it's, am I going where the people that I want to hire are? Because you put a lot of onus on people who are of a diverse nature to have to come to you, right? They're having to do all of the work to scream sometimes in what feels like an open void to be heard and seen and validated. And so how do I right that wrong by going to them instead of waiting for them to come to me? And that can be difficult. So it's get out there and go find the people you want to hire and where they are and be willing to take a chance on them because you're not going to regret it.
It's not as simple as just a LinkedIn post, right? I've been involved with a lot of companies that are like, okay, everybody post online that we're hiring. And that's right. Like you may get 1,000 applicants. That doesn't mean that you're going to get the people that you really actually need to apply. Right. And sometimes for me, I would rather meet somebody in a community, whether it's through Rev Genius, right. Or Women in Sales or at a Pavilion event. Right. And actually talk to them and say, wow, I had a really interesting conversation. We didn't talk about business. We talked about, you know, their personal life, my personal life. And oh, by the way, they're actually on the market. Oh, why would we not, you know, bring them into the hiring process?
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, let's flip the script here and pretend now that we're someone, right, who is looking for a job and we want to be somewhere that is really focused on being, you know, DE&I, right? Like really focused on that. So how do we make sure that we're actually involved in an organization that's putting an emphasis on this?
Ask questions very early on in the interview process and do it in a graceful but very direct way, right? Talk about what are the benefits that you have for mothers or LGBTQIA. Ask them how they ensure not only diversity of race and belief, but diversity of thought. Out like their comp bands and be like, how do you ensure equitable pay? And if you put all of your people on paper, am I going to see a discrepancy that is either gender related or sex related or preference related, right? Am I going to find these gaps? Like asking those questions very early on, a company that truly embraces DE&I will not only love the fact that you're asking those questions, they'll have that information readily available because they care about it. And if you're talking to a company like, well, we don't have that or we don't release that, it means they're not looking at it. The red flags are there from the very beginning.
Yeah, that's a really great way of going about it too, because I mean, I think when you're starting off in an interview process, you're always trying to you want to make yourself look good. And you're almost seen as like the student, which is like trying to be the goody good two shoes. But at the same time, you need to be interviewing them, right? You need to make sure that they fit your requirements. And so actually laying out a set of questions, like you just said, makes total sense. And when you know that they actually fit what you want, it's only going to make the success of your ramp and onboarding better.
That's right.
We got through all 5 sour takes. Now, I'd love for you to drop just a couple bits of nuggets about what you're doing with your company right now. It's a little bit of a plug, shameless plug, whatever. I'd love to hear about it because I'm very interested in the ramping, especially using tech.
Yeah, absolutely. So the gap that we are trying to fill is the inability right now for folks in go-to-market to practice. And there's a lot of companies that are focusing on training and a lot of great individuals and even companies that focus on coaching, but practice right now is usually done with uncomfortable internal role plays or live fire conversations with customers. And we can use some of the incredible conversational intelligence and AI that exists to be able to learn really, really quickly what your company looks like, what your prospects might sound like, how they might act from a qualitative and quantitative standpoint. And that can be attitude, right? Like, are most of your prospects easygoing, right? Are they confrontational? Are they skeptical, right? Like, how do we make sure that a realistic simulated environment to practice so that you can go and nail that conversation or that skill. And so we are currently under stealth mode, although maybe by the time this airs, we won't be, but certainly building the team, building the product, working with our design partners to build the cool product. Like it's going to be a cool product, but what I actually care about it a lot more is the function over the form. And so how do we build something that is going to meaningfully impact our ability to learn at work and fix what's broken? So that's what I'm focused on.
I love that. Is there any, can you drop who is getting involved in the company?
I can't yet, but when this airs, maybe I will be able to, but we have some unbelievable advisors involved. I've just hired on an incredible chief product officer. I have a director of biz ops. I have some wonderful designers and an incredible company alongside us. Some of the top engineers and data scientists in the world that are helping to build this product. So I feel very, very lucky and excited to be leading the ship.
I cannot wait to see the release of your product and can't wait to be a cheerleader for you. And I am just so excited we were able to meet at the dinner a few weeks ago and then actually get to shoot this live. I think it was just an amazing experience for me to be able to learn from you. And if there was anything you wanted to leave the viewers here today, just top of mind, what would it be as they are ending this, they're wrapping this up?
As a joke, I would say I avoid those last two candies at all costs. They're not good. Won't enjoy them. Trick your friends with them. Absolutely. And outside of that, I think one of the essences of this entire conversation has been giving wonderful people a chance to shine. And I think that can just kind of be the essence of what we've been talking about is believing in great people.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Christina. It was a pleasure, you know, being with you today. You can follow Christina on LinkedIn. She'll be releasing her product in the next couple months. You can follow the Go-to-Market SaaS Hacks podcast on LinkedIn. You can follow me. I'll be releasing updates all the time. Christina, again, thank you so much. I hope you have a wonderful day. Let's definitely grab coffee in Chicago soon.
You got it. Thanks for having me.
See ya.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Taking the Lead. If you're looking for more inspiring stories from women leaders in B2B tech, then visit us at motionagency.io/takingthelead.